Roy Sullivan was convinced that thunderclouds were following him. He went a bit funny in the end, but it's not surprising. He's not the only one. Have you heard of Tsutsumo Yamaguchi? Yamaguchi was on a business trip to the town of Hiroshima, and he was 3 miles from the epicenter of the bomb. He was temporarily blinded. He was deafened permanently in one ear. He stayed in a shelter that night, and the next day he made his way home to Nagasaki. And Yamaguchi is the only man recognized by the Japanese government as having been a victim of both bombs. And in fact, he lived to the age of 93, so he survived. But my all-time favorite is Anne Hodges of Oak Grove, Alabama. In 1954, she was minding her own business, lying on her couch, having a snooze, when a meteorite crashed through the roof, bounced off her furniture, and hit her in the side. She is the only human being ever known to have been hit by a meteorite. And to add insult to the injury, the US government confiscated the meteorite, and she had to go to court afterwards to get it back. Do you think they asked themselves, what did I do to deserve this? Why me? I think that's something that we all go through now and again, because we're all wired to look for a reason when things happen to us. And when we come to the book of Job, that's very much the mindset of those days. The mindset was, you reap what you sow. And if you're evil, your life will be short and bad. If you're good, you'll have a long life and things will work out well for you. Your kids will be well behaved, your wife will love you, and so on. It's an old idea. It goes back to the Bible. You can find it in various places, in the Psalms, for example, or in the book of Ecclesiastes. But it's not just an old idea, because many people nowadays still have this idea of karma. And yes, to some extent, you do reap what you sow. If you drink too much, you'll get cirrhosis of the liver. If you eat too much, you'll get overweight and you might have a heart attack. So there is some truth in it. But nevertheless, I've heard somebody say that they were ill, they think, because of something that they did. And that's the idea of karma, that I'm being punished for my actions. And I'd like to suggest to you that that's not what the Bible teaches. Certainly not in the New Testament. And you may live to a ripe old age even if you were evil. But we'll come back to that in a minute. Go ahead and see the first slide. Thomas, you manage that? I showed this one last Christmas, or a couple of Christmases ago. He's making a list. He's checking it twice. He's going to find out who's naughty or nice. He knows if you've been bad or good, so be good for goodness sake. Because if you're good, you'll get a present. And if you're bad, you won't. And that's the law of karma. It's the same in Germany. You've got Krampus, who comes to you, boys and girls who are naughty, with his sack of coal. It takes them away in his sack. So the idea is that if you behave, good things happen to you. If you don't behave, bad things happen to you. So even today, it's still being put around. There are some books in the Bible that are more difficult than others. My Bible notes, daily Bible notes, are going through the book of Ecclesiastes. And the guy who writes them is a man called Selwyn Hughes. He's died, but his notes are excellent. But even Selwyn Hughes is struggling with Ecclesiastes, no doubt about that. And when I was a young Christian, I was 17 at the time, I remember it, because the pastor of the church decided to do a series on the Song of Solomon. Now, when you're 17, you're very interested in the Song of Solomon. But we were very disappointed, because he told us it was all about Christ and the church, not about what we thought it was all about. Well, he got through two sermons, and then he decided it wasn't profitable to continue. I think he'd flogged that horse as far as he could go, and that was it. But we all know that the Song of Solomon isn't about Christ and the church necessarily, but people don't preach about it. And I fear it's the same with Job. We don't often hear sermons on the book of Job because it's quite difficult to deal with. And for our modern mindset, it's quite a hard book. I mentioned Ecclesiastes. Here's what Solomon says in the book of Ecclesiastes. To the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. Do you believe that? Is that what happens in the world as a whole, generally speaking? Is that what Jesus taught? Luke 13. Now there were some present who told Jesus about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. And Jesus answered, "Do you think that those Galileans were worse sinners than all the other Galileans because they suffered this way? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you too will all perish. Or those 18 who died when the tower in Siloam fell on them, do you think they were more guilty than all the others living in Jerusalem? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you too will perish." Jesus explicitly rejects the idea that the good are blessed and the bad are cursed. Stuff happens to all of us, whether we're good or bad. And that means that when something happens to you, don't immediately assume you're being punished. We naturally tend to think that way. Jesus said that in the Sermon on the Mount that the sun rises on the evil and the good, and that God sends rain on the just and the unjust. Both are treated equally, whether they're good or they're bad. There's an expression for that. It's called common grace. That God sends his grace on all men, no matter what they're like. So with that setting the scene, let's come to Job. And I'm afraid I'm going to have to deal with Job far too quickly. It would take a series of sermons, maybe 15, maybe 20, to deal with the book of Job. I want to give you an overview of what it actually says. And I'm going to read parts of the book from The Message. It's a paraphrase, I know, but it's so dramatic. It brings out what Job is experiencing and what's happening very well. So let me start. Job was a man who lived in Uz. He was honest inside and out, a man of his word who was totally devoted to God and hated evil with a passion. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. He was also very wealthy, 7,000 head of sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 teams of oxen, 500 donkeys, and a huge staff of servants. The most influential man in all the East. His sons used to take turns hosting parties in their homes, always inviting their 3 sisters to join them. When the parties were over, Job would get up early and sacrifice a burnt offering for each of his children, thinking maybe one of them sinned by defying God inwardly. And Job made a habit of this sacrificial atonement in case they'd sinned. So Job, he was a good person, wasn't he? He was honest inside and out, a man of his word, totally devoted to God, hated evil with a passion. I think we should be clear, though, that the Bible is not saying that Job was perfect. I can't help feeling that sacrificing every day for every child is a bit on the obsessive compulsive side. And right at the end of the book, God has a go at Job. And he says to him, "Why do you confuse the issue? Why do you talk without knowing what you're talking about? Pull yourself together, Job. Get on your feet." Job does whine rather a lot in the book. So I don't think whining is sin. I think we all do it. Notice, by the way, that his wealth is measured in livestock. That puts him at the time of the patriarchs, maybe 1700 BC, long before any other book of the Bible. Notice that his name is not a Hebrew name. Uz is not in Israel, it's a part of Arabia. So the whole thing is set in a context that's got nothing to do with the Bible, generally speaking. It's not Israel, it's not Israelites, and yet Job worships God. Not gods, he worships God. So that's an interesting fact. Then an extraordinary thing happens. One day when the angels came to report to God, Satan, who was the designated accuser — Satan is not his name, Satan is his title, his job description. Satan, who was a dedicated accuser, came along with them, and God singled out Satan and said, "What have you been up to?" Satan answered God, "Going here and there, checking things on earth." God said to Satan, "Have you noticed my friend Job? There's no one quite like him, honest and true to his word, totally devoted to God and hating evil." And Satan retorted, "Do you think Job does all this out of the sheer goodness of his heart? No one's ever had it so good. You pamper him like a pet, making sure nothing bad ever happens to him or his family or his possessions. You bless everything he does. You can't lose. What do you think would happen if you reached out and took away everything that's his? He'd curse you right to your face, he would. That's what. And God replied, well, go ahead. Do what you want with him. Just don't hurt him. And then Satan left the presence of God. And God allowed Satan to destroy Job's life. He didn't do it himself. Please note that. Job allowed Satan to do it. And we read in Job, the book of Job, that the Sabaeans attacked his livestock from the south. The Chaldeans attacked him from the north. Job's livestock was all stolen or it was struck by lightning. His 10 children died in a tornado in the house of the oldest son. So all Job's left with is himself and his wife. How did he react? I can't tell you how to react when bad stuff happens to people generally, but I can tell you how to react when it happens to you or to me. You know, I'm 70, and I fear that I come across as smug, because I generally had a fairly easy life. Being married to Mary helps. But you know what? It wasn't always like that. And I can remember in my 20s being desperately lonely. At that time, I was unemployed for a time. I still dream sometimes about being single. And I wake up, you know, and I think, oh, there she is. I had a broken engagement. So, all right, maybe I'm smug now, but I wasn't always. Things have happened, like they happen to everybody. And I've had several hospital stays in my younger years too, as Mary will bear witness to. So, when bad things happen to me, I know what's happened and how I've reacted. By the way, the title, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, comes from a book by a rabbi, Harold Kushner. Harold Kushner saw his son die before his eyes at the age of 14. He'd been born with a hereditary gene defect, and he just got older and older. Even at 14, he looked like an old man, and he died. And Kushner wrote the book about it, which was a bestseller. Unfortunately, Kushner's book says, well, God would like to help. You know, he'd like to help. He really would. But there's a lot happening in the world. Can't do everything at once. So he believes in a rather powerless God. But let's look at how Job reacts to all this happening to him. He's lost his livelihood. He's lost his children. Everything's gone. Job got to his feet, ripped his robe, shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground and worshipped. Naked I came from my mother's womb. Naked I'll return to the womb of the earth. God gives, God takes. God's name ever be blessed. And then it says, not once through all this did Job sin. Not once did he blame God. That's extraordinary. Because our natural reaction is to shake our fists at God when things go wrong. Why are you allowing this to happen to me? And that actually is a scriptural thing to do as well. Why are you doing this? Excuse me, I'll take a drink. Now, Job doesn't know that it wasn't God that took it away from him. It was Satan. But even though he thinks it was God, he still accepts that God gives and God takes. And that's his attitude. Could you have reacted like that? To an awful thing like that? I believe that Christians can. And do. And I want to give you some examples. Now, some of them you've heard before, but nevertheless, I think it would be useful. Can we look at slide 2? And there's an old man. Martin Rinkert. You've heard me mention him before. He spent his professional life in the town of Eilenburg in Saxony, near Dresden. It was a walled town, and during the 30 Years' War, when there were marauding bands of soldiers, people went into the town for safety, and they brought plague with them. It was overcrowded. They were starving. The bishop of the town absconded. Two of the clergymen died. So Martin Rinkert was the only clergyman left. He buried 40 to 50 people a day. In total, 4,480 by himself. One of the people he buried was his wife. After all this, there was a famine, despite the fact that the population had been halved. He also acted as a negotiator when the Swedes came. He negotiated some money to send them away again. He had a dreadful life. And what did he do? During this time, he wrote these words, "Now thank we all our God." Nun danket alle Gott. He trusted God, despite the awfulness of his surroundings, despite the dreadful things that were happening to him personally and to his town. He trusted God. Now the next slide, and this is a song we've just sung. Horatio Spafford, "When Peace Like a River." I think I've said this before, but in case you haven't heard it, let me remind you. Spafford was a top lawyer in Chicago. He was a senior partner in the firm. He made a lot of money. He put the money into property in Chicago, and unfortunately, in 1871, most of Chicago burnt down, the Great Fire. He lost everything. That year, his four-year-old son, his only son, died of leukemia. He was devastated. A couple of years later, he sent his wife and his four daughters to Britain because he was friendly with D.L. Moody, Dwight Moody, the evangelist, and he wanted them to go and meet with Moody and listen to him. On the voyage, the boat was rammed by another boat. His four daughters drowned. His wife sent him a telegram with the words, "Saved alone." And then he himself got on a boat to go over there, and he asked them to go over the area where his daughters had drowned, and while he was there, he wrote those words, "When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever of my lot thou hast taught me to say, it is well with my soul." Here's a man saying that when four of his daughters have died on that very spot. But he could do that because he knew God. He trusted God, despite the fact that it was awful. Last one. Georg Müller. Extraordinary man. He was German, but he lived most of his life in Bristol in England. He founded an orphanage. He brought up over his lifetime something like 10,000 orphans. He was criticized because he was raising the poor above their station. His wife Mary died in her 40s, and the next day he preached. And here's what he says in his sermon. "I now rejoice as I realize how far happier she is in beholding her Lord whom she loved so well than in any joy she has known or could know here. I ask you also to pray that the Lord will so enable me to have fellowship in her joy that my bereaved heart may be occupied with her blessedness instead of my unspeakable loss." He wasn't pretending that things were right. He wasn't pretending that he was happy, clappy. It was a terrible time, but he rejoiced for her, and he asked people to pray for him. I think that's fair enough. At a funeral, he preached from Psalm 119, verse 68. The verse says, "You are good, and what you do is good. Teach me your degrees." Here's what he said, short paraphrase. He said, "The Lord was good and did good. First, in giving her to me. Second, in so long leaving her to me, and third, in taking her from me." How could Martin Rinkert, Horatio Spafford, Georg Müller say what they said after the awful things they had been through? And the only answer I can give is because they knew their Lord and trusted him and knew that he would keep them safe till the end. So we're back to Job. He's lost his wife. He's lost everything apart from his wife. And I'm afraid she's not much help to him, as we're about to see. God says to Satan, "Job still has a firm grip on his integrity. You tried to trick me into destroying him, but it didn't work." Satan answered, "A human would do anything to save his life. Well, what do you think would happen if you reached down and took away his health? He'd curse you to your face, that's what." God said, "All right. Go ahead, you can do what you like with him, but mind you, don't kill him." Satan left God and struck Job with terrible sores. He was all ulcers and scabs from head to foot. They itched and oozed so badly that he took a piece of broken pottery to scrape himself and went and sat on a trash heap. His wife said, "Still holding on to your precious integrity, are you? Curse God and be done with it." He told her, "You're talking like an empty-headed fool. We take the good days from God Why not also the bad days? Not once through all this did Job sin. He said nothing against God. Now, God did not do any of this. He permitted it to happen. We talked a bit earlier about God's permissive will rather than his absolute will. So he permitted this to happen. You'll notice, if you read the papers, that Pope Francis is concerned about the Lord's Prayer. He thinks the common English translation is a bit misleading. Do not lead us into temptation. He'd like a new version. I know I have in the past the Lord's Prayer where it says, do not put us to the test. Unfortunately, what the Greek actually says is, do not lead us into temptation. So whether you like it or not, I don't think you can change it simply because it's slightly inconvenient for us. But nevertheless, even though it's the devil's job, and that's precisely what the devil did, Job was led into temptation and he didn't give in. Now, let's not be too hard on Mrs. Job. She'd lost 10 children and she lost her status, lost all security, and that matters. I think we can understand her reaction. He pulled through. We take the good days from God, why not also the bad days? And sometimes in Christian culture, there's a feeling that we ought to act happy even when things are awful. And I can't do that. I think Mary will tell you, you can see in my face what I'm really thinking. So I'm not the happy clappy type, I'm afraid. I think that's honest. And we ought to be. And Job is honest. He's in a miserable state and he knows it, but he doesn't blame God. I've said there's a distinction between God's sovereign will and his permissive will. God's sovereign will means that what he decrees will happen. But there's also his permissive will. That means that God allows stuff to go on in the world. He allows us to make our own mind up about things. He allows Eve to be persuaded by the serpent. He allows Adam to accept the apple from Eve. So things happen that God doesn't directly control because he allows it to happen. He allows us to have control over our lives, to make our own minds up. Here's what Oswald Saunders says about this. Oswald Saunders says about this. God's perfect will is unchangeable. It's with his permissive will, or the various things that he allows into our lives, that we must wrestle before him. It's our reaction to these things that enables us to come to the point of seeing his perfect will for us. We know that all things work together for good to those that love God, to those who remain true to God's perfect will. But God's permissive will is the testing he uses to reveal his true sons and daughters. The great Terry Pratchett said, everything's a test. And I think there's some truth in that. All of our lives are a test. Every time something happens to you, it's a test. When somebody does something stupid in the car in front of me, it's a test. And I fail regularly. But nevertheless, that's the case. Problem is, our brains are wired to look for patterns. We want to find a reason in why things happen. And sometimes we can. Joseph said, you intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done to the saving of many lives. Have you read J.I. Packer's book, Knowing God? Come across that? In that, he talks about his childhood in York, and he mentions something called the York signal box fallacy. He was a train spotter. You like to go and see the trains going backwards and forwards and the shunting of the trains. He imagined that if he could be in the signal box that controlled all this, he could see what was going on. And he thought if he could get into God's will enough, he could know what God was up to and what was going on. But from the name, you can see it's a fallacy. You and I will never know why God is doing what he is doing. We just got to accept it and carry on and live our lives despite the fact that things are not working out the way we would like them to work out. And things have not happened the way we would like them to happen. We've got no control over other people's lives. We've got very little control over our own lives a lot of the time. Our work may not go the way we want it to. Our marriage may not be as happy as we'd like it to be. Our children may not go in the direction that we want them to go. But nevertheless, we have to accept that we have only limited control over these things, and God has overall control. I know it's not a help, but we have to accept that. Unanswered prayer is a test. I know the correct response is that no is an answer, but it hurts. You're praying for something over and over again, and it doesn't happen. Mary and I have prayed for how many years? Every night that our older daughter come to Christ. But it hasn't happened yet. That won't stop us carrying on in prayer. But nevertheless, it hurts. Right. Time is short. It is going quickly. Can we have the next slide? William Blake did a whole series of pictures, great engravings about Job. He liked Job. These are Job's comforters. And there's Job's wife on the left. And there are three of the four comforters. And here's what the Bible says. Three of Job's friends heard all the trouble that had befallen him. Each travelled from his own country, Eliphaz from Teman, Bildad from Shunah, Zophar from Naamath, and all went together to help Job and keep him company and comfort him. When they first caught sight of him, they couldn't believe what they saw. They hardly recognised him. They cried out in lament, ripped their robes and dumped dirt on their heads as a sign of their grief. Then they sat with him on the ground. 7 days and seven nights they sat there without saying a word. They could see how rotten he felt, how deeply he was suffering. You know what? I think they behaved well, personally. 7 days they just sat there and kept their mouths shut. If I could do it for 7 minutes, Mary would be pleased. So we can't criticise them. You've got to let people speak. They waited for him. I think that's fair enough. They were sincere friends, even if in the end they were sincerely wrong. And in Middle Eastern fashion, they each speak in order of age. The oldest speaks first. Eliphaz, and then Bildad, and then Zophar. And for chapter after chapter after chapter of the book of Job, they all say the same thing. And what they say is, if you are suffering, there must be some sin in your life that is causing it. Because if you weren't a sinner, God would not allow this to happen to you. Well, Job gets very angry, but they keep on about it. If you're being punished, it's because you deserve it. You might deny your sins, but they're there. And the sooner you get them out in the open, the better. Come on, Job, you were rich. You don't get rich like that without cutting a few corners. So what did you do? Who did you cheat? How did you get that wealth? That's how they thought. And that was Eliphaz, the oldest, and theoretically the wisest, is the one who talks like this. Then comes Bildad. He says the same kind of stuff. You know, if you're suffering, it's because of your sin. You always reap what you sow. And he knows the theory. And he can't accept that Job is really righteous. If he's suffering, there must be something in his life that's causing this. All sorts of hidden sins must be there, even if he won't acknowledge it. And then Zophar, the last one, the youngest, he's the one I find painful, because Zophar is what you might call a theoretician. He knows all the right answers, but unfortunately it just doesn't work with Job. He knows that if Job is suffering, he must have done something, there must be a reason for it. Why doesn't Job come out with a reason? He gets very annoyed. He can't accept that Job really is righteous. So there must be sin or it wouldn't happen. Now there's a fourth person. I won't spend much time on him. Elihu, he's the only one with a Jewish name. And he's clearly very young. He says he's young, and he spoke last, which is a sign that he's young. And he complains that the others haven't answered Job adequately. And he lays it on thick, like the others do. If you're suffering, it must be because of unconfessed sin. You can't possibly be righteous. Well, if you read the book, you'll see that Job gets very angry with them. And is pretty firm with them. Do you really believe that the wicked suffer? Look around you. Do you see people who are suffering? I think we can say that about our world too. There are many people in our world doing very well for themselves, even though it's clear that they are wicked. And being unjustly accused, as Job was, is a horrible, horrible thing. There's a British pop singer that goes back to the 1960s, Cliff Richard. He's now Sir Cliff Richard. He's not known in America, but he's well known in Europe and in Britain. Some years back, Cliff was accused of being a paedophile. And the BBC were allowed by the police to film a police raid on his mansion. They filmed the house being searched. They went into the house. Now, Sir Cliff's a believer. He was involved in the youth group that I was involved in my younger days. And he immediately withdrew from all Christian work. He wouldn't do any concerts. He wouldn't do anything. No interviews, nothing. Until it came out that the man doing the accusing was a fantasist. And it turns out the police had been witch hunting. And he was completely, totally exonerated. But he was interviewed last week on British TV. And what comes out is the hurt, the anger, the horror that somebody like that could be accused of something like that with no evidence whatsoever. He's just so upset, so angry. He wants the law changed to stop this happening again. He wants the law changed so that people who are accused of this kind of thing are not identified until they are charged, which I think is fair enough. So, can you imagine that Job must have felt the same way? He's been accused of all sorts of things, and he has no sense that he's in the wrong. So, just as Sir Cliff must have felt like that, did feel like that, you could see it on his face, Job must have felt the same way. I think the trial we face is lack of confidence. I think when things go wrong for us, our fear is that God is not in control, that he's not in charge, and that stuff is just happening and there's nothing we can do about it. Do you really believe that he who began a good work in you will carry on to completion until the day of Jesus? That all things work together for good to them that love him, that are called according to his purpose? Do you believe that even the hairs of your head are numbered? That you're worth more than many sparrows? How did these men that we've looked at come through all this? Because they believed that they trusted their God. George Muller is famous for one other thing. He's famous for the time that there was no food in the orphanage, because he never asked for money, with the result that the day came when there was no milk and no bread. And he called the children in for breakfast, and he gave thanks despite the fact that there was no food. And at that moment, a bread cart broke down outside the orphanage. And the man said, well, I can't deliver it today. You might as well have the bread. And a milkman came along and said, I've got too much milk. Would you like some? You couldn't make it up. He had confidence in his God, a way that I fear we most of the time don't. They trusted God, these men. Martin Rinkert, George Muller, Horatio Stafford. Even though things were bad, they trusted God. Job says, so how could I ever argue with him? Construct a defense that would influence God. Even though I'm innocent, I could never prove it. I can only throw myself on the judge's mercy. And you and I need to do that. That's one of my prayers at night. Have mercy, O Lord, have mercy on me. Because I know what I'm like. I know I'm a sinner. Another thing Job says is he wishes there was somebody there to intercede for him. He says, there must be someone in heaven who knows the truth about me. Some attorney who can clear my name, a champion, a friend. Well, I'm weeping my eyes out before God. I appeal to the one who represents mortals before God as a neighbour. Stand up for a neighbour. Who do you think that is? Who's the one who stands up for us before God? Who's interceding at the right hand of the Father for us, for you and me? Even though we are sinners, even though we do stuff that's wrong, he is there looking after us, interceding for us, seeking God, seeking our best. Finally, we're nearly at the end now. Maybe we should talk about how the book ends. So can we have the last slide? There's God coming out of the whirlwind. And for four whole chapters, God lays it on thick with Job. And he has a go at the friends. He says about the friends, you haven't been honest either with me or about me. Not the way my friend Job has. My friend Job. Sometimes some versions of my servant Job. Only 10 people in the whole of the Old Testament God refers to as my servant. And Job is one of them. So he's pretty righteous. And he tells the friends to take bulls and rams and sacrifice them. And then he says, my friend Job will pray for you and I will accept his prayer. He will ask me not to treat you as you deserve, talking nonsense, and for not being honest with me as he has. Job was honest. He was suffering. He made it clear. He said what he thought. But he never criticized God. God calls Job his friend. All right, Job's been tetchy with his friends. He's whined a lot. He's wished he were dead. He's been rude to his wife. And contrary to the saying, the patience of Job, I don't think Job shows much patience in his book. He gets pretty annoyed with people. And I think we need to bear that in mind. So, the book of Job. God uses suffering in our lives in ways that we cannot understand. Sometimes he does it to produce character. We're told that those who live a godly life will encounter persecution. We're told that we will have trouble in this world. And it's not wrong to pray to God to minimize it. But let's have faith that he who began a good work in you will carry on to completion until the day of Christ Jesus. Amen.